Welcome to the Science Podcast for May 18th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein, and we're doing something a little different this week. Each interview you'll hear on the show is related to topics from today's special issue of Science on human conflict, including the evolution of violent conflict, the roots of racism, and the fundamentals of peace systems. The whole issue is free with registration and can be found at www.sciencemag.org/site/special/conflict.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Joining me today is Sasha Vinieri, one of the co-editors of the special issue on human conflict. Welcome to the show, Sasha.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So before we move into our interviews, I'd like to ask you a little bit about this special issue. So why this topic? Why human conflict and why now?
Well, I think it's something that we're faced with daily. We see it on the news. Violent conflict is all around us in the modern world. And I think many people wonder whether it can be avoided, and if so, how. And I think what many people don't understand is that science has a lot to teach us about conflict. Many questions have been looked at from a scientific perspective, and I think now is a good time to examine whether we can learn anything from this perspective.
And so what are some of the big questions in this field?
So I think some of the big questions, first and foremost, is what's the history of conflict? Is it part of our human nature? Does it have deep evolutionary roots, or is it something that's learned that we can perhaps unlearn? Another thing that people are interested in is whether or not it's changed. Some people speculate we've become more violent. Other people say less. And then the big question is, can we do away with it? Can we develop peace in our global society that we now live in?
Right. And we'll get to most of that. But let's begin first by looking far into the past. War and conflict are not unique to modern humans. But though our ancient primate ancestors fought, they also found ways to mediate their differences. According to social anthropologist Christopher Boehm, conflict and its resolution have evolved together and can be traced through the development of Homo sapiens. Boehm spoke with me about his review and what conflict deep in our past can tell us about our future.
What the review is about is the natural history of both conflict and conflict resolution. And it would appear that they have co-evolved and that conflict is a major problem for humans. And it has precursors all the way back in an ancestor that I call ancestral pan. That's the shared ancestor of humans, bonobos, and chimpanzees, which lived approximately 5 to 7 million years ago.
And you describe this review as a phylogenetic analysis or a behavioral phylogenetic analysis. So can you just describe what that means and what that methodology entails?
Sure. Behavioral phylogenetics is a term coined by Brosnan, and it simply means that you take the behaviors of the living descendants within a clade or family, and you look for a major behavior that they all share. And if they all share it, there's a very good chance that their ancestors shared it as well. And that just comes out of the basic efficiency and simplicity of evolution itself.
So let's go back then to chimpanzees and bonobos, with whom we share this common ancestor. What is their capacity for conflict and conflict management?
Well, these species all have social dominance hierarchies. And that means that individuals are genetically prepared to dominate and to submit in situations of competition. So that if there's food available or if there are two males competing for the same mate, then you have competition, and generally one individual dominates, the other submits, and everything goes smoothly. If one dominates and the other wants to dominate also, things don't go so smoothly. And that's where conflict interventions come in. One is simply by the two parties to the conflict reconciling. And what they do is restore previous, more amicable relations and basically get rid of the conflict. Where they can't do it or aren't doing it, you have third parties who, in one way or another, will try to resolve the conflict for the two who are at conflict. And one way that this happens with chimpanzees and occasionally with bonobos is that simply a power figure threatens the two that are fighting and basically gets their attention, makes them stop, and then stays nearby until they've calmed down and things are normal again.
Kind of like a teacher breaking up a fight in school.
Very much, or very much like in a bar fight where people step in between the two combatants.
Well, next in your paper, you discuss hunter-gatherers, early modern humans. How did they deal with conflict, and how did this compare and contrast with these other species?
There's no other species that is moral, and morality, of course, is part of our conflict resolution ideology. We believe in resolving conflicts, and we put pressure on people not to engage in conflicts. However, not all conflicts can be headed off in that way. And we have other methods of resolving conflicts. One is to distract the individuals who are about to fight. Another is to step in and stop the fight by sheer physical strength, something you cannot do in a hunter-gatherer band very well, simply because hunter-gatherers are egalitarian. They don't allow that kind of authority to develop. If we think about what our ancestors were doing, the chances are that our ancestors were doing these power interventions and they also were reconciling on a one-on-one basis. If we look at what hunter-gatherers do, they're more likely to head off a conflict before it starts because they know that there's nobody around with enough authority to actually intervene and stop the fight once it's hot.
And you're inferring hunter-gatherer behavior based on modern-day societies of foragers.
Yes, I have a methodology for arriving at behaviors of hunter-gatherers who were prehistoric but were culturally modern. That is, they had the same cultural level we do. They had pretty much the same gene pool, and we may assume very much the same behaviors. And we simply look at hunter-gatherers who live today but could have been living in the Pleistocene, and you can project from their main behavior tendencies to create main behavior tendencies back in the late Pleistocene around 45,000 years ago, or whenever it was that humans became culturally modern.
So as hunter-gatherer societies evolved, they became more egalitarian and more moral, and yet conflict and homicide still happened.
Very, very high rates of conflict and homicide, actually. Homicide rates are comparable to a large city in modern times. And one of the things that enables hunter-gatherers to deal with conflict is simply the fact that they live in small bands with membership that is not permanent. People are moving from band to band all the time. If they have a conflict, they can just move rather than act the conflict out. Also, if there's a serious conflict that results in homicide, then the killer will quickly get out of that band and go to a very far away band because he knows that the relatives of the person he's killed are going to want to kill him. So that's one way that we see hunter-gatherers avoiding chains of conflict that could be extremely disruptive to band life.
And since the Pleistocene, our civilization has made leaps and bounds. How has then conflict and resolution changed since then, and has culture played a role in that change?
Well, our cultural evolution has involved living in much more large and dense populations, and with larger, denser populations comes a greater need for command and control at the political center. And as a result, for example, tribal farmers allot a bit more authority to their chiefs in order to give them the authority to stop conflicts, because these guys can't move away from each other so readily. They've invested in farming. And then as we move on up, of course, there are chiefdoms, in which you have social classes developing. And then chiefdoms just seem to lead naturally to kingdoms and then to early states and, of course, eventually to modern nations. And once you have a chiefdom, you have a guy at the political center who has quite a bit of authority. He can stop fights, even if they're getting pretty hot. Once you get a kingdom or a state, you actually have something like an army or a police force at the political center that will do the bidding of the central leader. And at that point, you can step in with power and do power interventions of a type that are somewhat reminiscent of the ancestral ones, in that you use power that is greater than the combined power of the two who are fighting. So even if they want to combine and fight you in order to have the right to fight, they still have to stop because you've outpowered them or outmuscled them. So in that way, the entire area of conflict and conflict resolution has been transformed. People still have conflicts for the same old reasons, but we no longer live in egalitarian bands where spatial removal is the main means of dealing with a serious conflict.
Right. Our peacemaking efforts have increased, certainly in power, but so have our wars, our conflicts.
Yes, and they certainly are a case of an arms race. The worse conflict gets, the better the resolution has to be. And one of our problems, I think, in the modern world is that although nations are pretty well set up to stop internal conflicts, we, of course, do have civil wars. There are lots and lots of cases where national governments have not been able to handle all their conflicts, but basically they're pretty good at it. If you look at the international scene, there we have something that looks a little bit like a national government that has been disempowered, as it were. The United Nations has a General Assembly that is all but powerless politically. We have a Security Council whose dedicated job it is to intervene in serious conflicts and keep them from affecting the entire planet. But we also have a veto, which makes certain that if a large nuclear power is involved in the conflict, that it can simply cast a veto and not be subject to external control. So we do not have a very efficient system. And this is where the gene culture coevolution comes in that the genes are still making us do the same old things, which include quite a bit of conflict. Culture has given us solutions at various levels, from hunter-gatherers to chieftains to early states and to modern nations. But the world conflict resolution system still needs quite a bit of work.
Very interesting. Well, Chris Boehm, thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I enjoyed the interview.
That was Christopher Boehm discussing his review about the coevolution of conflict and peacemaking.
Science contributing editor Elizabeth Culotta writes in this issue about another aspect of the evolution of conflict, the roots of human racism. Being social creatures, humans tend to gravitate towards others with similar interests, from kickball teams to political parties. But, as Culotta tells Sarah Crespi, this tendency to form communities goes hand in hand with conflict.
You know, it started because I was in a meeting a couple years ago listening to a psychologist named Susan Fiske talk about her work. And she actually was not talking about outgroup prejudice, which is what I wrote about. She was talking about prejudice against women. But I realized as I heard her talk that psychologists have really generated a body of work that really looks at a fundamental part of human nature, which is our tendency to form groups. And it's a tendency that I think is so common that we often don't even see that it's there. I mean, this is what we do. This is everything from sports teams to gangs to nations. We form coalitions, and sometimes those coalitions compete or conflict or kill each other. And psychologists have really done a lot to explore this, and I became fascinated with it.
Well, so let's talk about some of the research that's gone into this area. Researchers have found that everyone has biases and that these appear to be innate. But the subject of the bias could be anybody. How do in-groups and out-groups form and affect our judgments?
Well, some of the surprising things about this actually goes back to studies they first did back in the 1970s. And they found that people like groups so much that people will favor members of their own group, even if that group is what they call a minimal group, even if it's somebody you've never met before. So psychologists will take people and give them the same shirt color, okay, or ask people to choose which modern painter they prefer. But then once those groups have formed, then people prefer their own groups. If they're playing a game, like a cooperative game where people might get money, they'll give more money to people in their in-group. If they have to judge a writing sample from members of their group or another group, they'll think that the people in their group wrote better.
Wow, so everyone on my team is smarter and above average.
That's right. Everybody on my team is smarter, nicer, above average, you know, really great.
So some of these experiments that scientists have done have shown that they're great at eliciting bias from the research subjects in the lab setting. Can you describe some of the ways that they've done that?
Sure. There's one pretty famous test called the implicit association test, and you can actually take this online. There's something called Project Implicit. 14 million people have taken these tests.
Wow.
And what these tests do is they show you photos and words, and they ask you to categorize them very quickly as either bad or good, or say old or young, black or white. And what they find is that people tend to associate, say, young and good more easily than they associate old and good. So it can uncover your implicit bias, and they look at how quickly you can move through the test and the pattern of your mistakes. So even if you think that you are completely neutral on this, or that you treat everybody equally, and even if in your conscious mind you do treat people equally, you have these implicit biases, these implicit associations.
Mm-hmm. Did you take the test?
I did. And I'm just like everybody else. You know, I prefer my in-group, and I also prefer young to old, which is unfortunate.
So this has been suggested that it's an evolutionarily selected trait. It's something that we've inherited from our ancient ancestors. But if this is an adaptive trait, this immediate fear or hatred of out-groups, it should have an advantage. What are the researchers you spoke with suggest that might be?
So there's a couple different things, but one of the most fundamental is this idea that way back on the African savanna, as our species was evolving, one of the most dangerous things we might encounter was lions, I suppose, but also members of other groups of humans with whom we might be competing. So if you are alone out there and you encounter a group of humans from another group, they might very well be hostile to you. And so the theory goes that we have evolved these very rapid ways of categorizing people. They don't take a lot of cognitive resources. It's like it's very fast, very quick, so that within a second, in tenths of a second, you can sum up like, okay, is this person likely to have hostile intentions towards me or not? Now, the thing about that is that it's extremely imperfect. It's just a sort of really fast, quick way to sort of see if you might be in danger or not. So it's very imperfect. And what it does is it often raises false alarms so that you might think that you're in danger, or you might think that this person is an outgroup who might be dangerous to you, when in fact there's no danger to you at all. So back in the savannah, that was okay if you had a few false alarms. But now in the modern world, those false alarms can raise problems for us, create prejudice where we don't want it.
In terms of evolving towards outgroup hatred, there's something of a which came first question. Did conflict lead to cooperation or vice versa? Can you set that problem up for us?
Yes. And in fact, this gets to something really fundamental, which is that many researchers think that part of the reason we have this is because for humans, the group is primary. And we all think of the key adaptation of humans as big brains. But in fact, another one is that we live in groups. We do everything in groups. If you visit a hunter-gatherer camp, you will find that the people around you will share everything with you, and everybody makes everybody else's day go smoothly. They'll loan a bow and arrow, a basket, water, sticks for firewood, you name it. And really, this constant flow of cooperation is how we get along in the world. The group buffers each individual against the environment. So it's really a crucial adaptation for us. But the thing is, if you have a group, an in-group, with whom you share and give and are nice and so on, then by definition, there's got to be an out-group. And so even if you're not actively hostile towards that out-group, the out-group is not going to get the favored treatment that the in-group does. So that almost by definition, we, meaning members of our group, are nicer and kinder and more honest and more generous than they.
So that's basically how, you know, being cooperative demands that you be exclusive about other people.
Right. And then there's another idea, which is that it's the reverse, the chicken and the egg question here, which is that if you have existing groups and they are battling each other, the groups who cooperate more are going to win.
Huh.
And this has been shown over and over. War in and of itself is when soldiers risk their lives for others, right? So they are sacrificing themselves. It's a very generous act, right? And so groups that cooperate more win more. That suggests that conflict may actually have encouraged more cooperation within the group. So it's a little hard to figure out which came first, and yet most researchers agree that whichever came first, these two tendencies reinforced each other. The need for the group, and then once groups existed and perhaps were in conflict, the fact that more cooperative groups won. So what you end up with in any case is cooperative groups.
So going back to modern times, data on large-scale prejudice seems to indicate that men are particularly hard hit by this. How do these theories fit with that?
They fit it pretty well, actually, because the idea here is that in ancient times, most of the warriors were probably men, so that if you actually were engaged in conflict with another group, it would have been men who were the most dangerous to you. At the same time, it would have been the men who were in the most danger, because the men are the ones who have to step up and perhaps go and attack this other group or defend themselves against another group. So then on both counts, you know, men are front and center. So researchers would predict then that, first of all, men would be more prejudiced than women, and there is data to show this. And they would also predict that outgroup men would face more prejudice than outgroup women do. And there's a lot of data to show that. For example, in our country, African Americans are an outgroup, and African American men face more prejudice than African American women do in all kinds of things: education, jobs, criminal sentences, even how much money you have to spend to buy a car.
Mm-hmm. And that holds true in other countries as well for different outgroups.
That's right. For example, in the United Kingdom, men from Southeast Asia face the same kind of prejudice.
But our biology is not necessarily our destiny, right? What can people do to overcome what seems to be an innate bias against others?
Absolutely, our biology is not our destiny. And I think, for me, this is a really important finding from my story, which is that the things that I was talking about are automatic responses, emotions, really, that arise in your mind. Mm. But that's before action. Okay, and that's before even conscious thought. And so what it means is that we do have conscious thought. The parts of our brains that are responding in this automatic way are pretty primitive, but we have our big, recently evolved brains. Actually, the conscious mind sometimes takes a little longer to get there. It might take a full second as opposed to a few tenths of a second. But if you can give it that second, right, then your conscious brain will kick in and you can actually think, now, do I want to act in a prejudiced manner or not?
Right.
And you can decide. And you can do that before you take any action. So that's why, for example, some people say if you want to be sure that these unconscious biases are not affecting you as you decide who to give a job to, if you're a manager, you might realize that if you're skimming through a whole bunch of applications and you're looking really quickly, you're looking quickly, so your unconscious biases may be at work. So what you might do is, after you've done that, look at the minority file and take your time, you know, engage your conscious mind deliberately and read those applications, and you might find something. Without even sort of saying necessarily, promising that you'll find a person there, just make sure you take the time to engage your conscious mind on the problem.
All right. Well, Elizabeth Culotta, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you, Sarah.
That was Elizabeth Culotta talking about her news story on the roots of racism. A lot of the stories in this issue focused on humans being wired for conflict. But anthropologist Douglas Fry addresses our peacemaking abilities. He argues that cooperation is an evolutionarily supported aspect of human nature and has identified both historical and modern examples of societies that function through the coexistence of different groups. Fry spoke with me about the characteristics of these so-called peace systems.
The main idea here is that humans certainly have a capacity to develop peace systems and to live without war. And the reason we have that capacity is clear, because there are existing peace systems ethnographically. Another, I think, important message is that we seem to be having a shift of perspective going on across different sciences, whereas there's a new recognition about the peace potential that humans have. And this type of perspective, although we're, of course, aware of it, has really taken second place to the perspective of competition, violence, warfare, and so forth.
Along those lines, you talk about how cultures have developed peace in a variety of different cultures that have developed this, and you use the term peace system to describe the traits that they've developed to reach this peace. Can you give me a little bit of an idea about what you mean by peace system and the consistent characteristics or traits that are found across the different examples you provide?
Yeah, sure. Peace systems basically are clusters of neighboring societies that don't make war with each other. And often they don't make war with outside societies as well. And there are several of these ethnographically. In Labrador Peninsula, the tribes that live there, for instance, are from Brazil, the Upper Xingu River Valley groups. There's 10 societies down there, 10 different cultures, speaking 4 different language groups that exist in a peace system where they get along well. And I mentioned the European Union in passing before. I mean, that's an intriguing example where after World War II, Europe was just in a state of horrible devastation in terms of physical destruction, lack of resources, the economy being in a mess, and, of course, people being homeless, suffering the aftermath of the war with many lives lost. And basically, one man was very important here, Jean Monnet, in terms of thinking very seriously about how can we redo European continent so that we eliminate the possibility of war in the future. So he and other key leaders really addressed themselves to this issue, and that was the main idea behind the European Union. And there may be economic problems going on in the Union today, but the main goal of the European Union, to eliminate the threat of war on the European continent, has been just highly successful. So it's a very effective peace system that has evolved and developed over a series of carefully implemented steps in the last 60-some years. So that's a great achievement. You asked about key elements. Let me try to boil it down to sort of three things which are interrelating with each other. We could talk about the ideology of peace, values that support it, symbolism, ceremonies, and so forth, that basically say that peace is a good thing and violence is not acceptable. Violence and war are not appropriate. And then going along with the ideology, I think you have what we could call a series of relationship features. So some of these are just interconnections among people, the trade relationships that interlink people economically, friendships, intermarriage. Sense of interdependence is really important in the European and other examples where the economies get linked to each other's in a way that creates this interdependence, which then makes the idea of fighting with each other inappropriate or even absurd. And there's also this element, which I like to call expanding the us, and it plays from the idea of the us versus the them, but it basically expands the us to include the them in the ideal possible world here. And these could be looked at all different levels of identification. So what we see with the European Union or with the Xingu system or something, these people are no longer perceiving themselves as just members of their own tribe or members of their own country, but they're also understanding that, oh, we're also Europeans. And what we really need to do, in my opinion, at the planet is raise it up and realize that we're all sharing a planet. We're interdependent in terms of many, many ways here on each other, and we need this additional level of identification to humanity.
Yeah, that's a really powerful approach that you mentioned, and I'm going to get back to that question at the end of the interview and how you maybe foresee how we might achieve this kind of global peace. But before we get there, you mentioned some clear and remarkable similarities that different cultures have reached in terms of coming up with a peace system. But these cultures that you mentioned are really quite different, the Xingu and the EU. How do you think that such different societies were able to converge on such similar peace systems?
That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I have a real thorough answer to it, but I'll just toss out a couple of ideas. There's another peace system I could mention that is a very important and good one, is the Iroquois Confederacy, the Great League of Peace. And this was the coming together initially of five different tribes who previously had been engaging in feud with each other and warfare, engaging in cannibalism and connection with the war and this type of thing. And it's a very intriguing case, again, parallel in some ways to the Upper Xingu people and so forth, in that they brought people from different groups, expanded the us, and perceived themselves as members of a larger community in which there would be unity and peace, and peace was, again, a major goal or purpose to this. What I didn't deal with before, I mentioned relationships and ideology is important. There's also the element of structure. Not everybody, but a certain number of people come to understand, I think, in the formation of these peace systems, that we need some sort of higher level of governance, or at least some higher level of dispute resolution. And this was very natural for the Iroquoians, because at their village level, they would have village councils that would deal with disputes within that village. So if there was a problem with adultery or a homicide or something like this, they would try to resolve it. But the problem came that when there was a feud between different villages or between different tribes, there was no way to deal with this without bloodshed. The Iroquois took their same basic model of a council of chiefs, council of elders, put it that way, at the village, and raised it up to like a council of chiefs across the five and then later sixth Iroquois tribe. So this is a way of using the same type of conflict resolution mechanism that's been very effective at a lower level and moving it up to a higher level. In fact, we do that in the United States with our series of courts. If you think about it, we have municipal courts to deal with city issues, state courts, and of course Supreme Court ultimately to deal with disputes at the highest level of government. So the model is the same, it's just applying it at different levels. And that's very parallel, in fact, to what some of these peace systems do.
It's actually really encouraging to hear you discuss the components of these peace systems, because in some ways it does seem very much that regardless of culture, aspects of our human nature lead us to sort of develop these. So we've discussed a little bit about you know, ways that you think that we could use these approaches for developing a peace system to actually build larger scale peace. Do you think it's possible to eliminate violent conflict in today's very complicated world through the establishment of something like a global peace system?
Well, yes. I mean, I have to say that, yes, it is possible. And, of course, the other side of that is it's a big challenge, but it is something that we could do. So that's the optimist in me speaking, of course. One reason that I say that it's possible, and I think we may be going in that direction, is that there are plenty of examples that when people do understand that they're interdependent on other people, then they tend to promote or enhance in a positive way that type of relationship. And certainly we have that today in the global sense. I mean, we're all sharing the same planet, which is facing global warming. That's a big one and an obvious one. And that's very important from this point of view of peace, because it's Titanic anniversary, right? The centennial. We're all on the same ship, basically, globally. And we're going to avoid the icebergs or not. So we need to work together on preventing species loss, for instance, preserving habitats, combating pollution of the air and the atmosphere, stopping global warming, like I say, is a big thing. These are all shared problems that we need to address collectively as a global society. And again, if you look at studies from psychology, even from primatology, what they've done in the laboratory of making two monkeys interdependent on getting food together, they'll work together and they'll appreciate that relationship and fight less and develop that. The key here, I think, is enough of us on the planet realizing and understanding, and then probably explaining it to our leaders, who will be the last ones to know, that we really are interdependent and need to work together to solve some of these problems. So nuclear weapons are not going to protect us from anything. I mean, they're part of the problem. Conventional warfare, that does not make us safe or secure. One thing I've realized from my anthropological readings and thinking about this in terms of what is important to people, people everywhere want to feel safe and secure. And then it becomes a question, well, how do we achieve that? And certainly trying to achieve it through warfare is no longer possible when we're on such an interdependent planet. So this is one reason why peace systems are just absolutely the way to go. Like I say, the good news here is when people understand this, that, gosh, we're linked together, we sink or we swim together, then people tend to work together.
Yeah, that's great. I really share your belief that working together will really be the key to helping us move forward and face our challenges. There are many that humanity faces in the future. I really appreciate your insight on these issues and very much appreciate your talking with us today. Thank you.
Well, sure. My pleasure.
That was Douglas Frye, who wrote a review about a world without war for this week's special issue.
So we've heard about the coevolution of conflict and resolution. We've learned about our conscious and unconscious tendencies toward prejudice, but we've also learned that conflict may not be inevitable. So what else is in this special issue?
Well, some of the things that interest me the most have to do with the natural basis for conflict and conflict resolution. And Ellemers writes about how our definition of ourselves can provide or prevent conflict, something that is essential for understanding modern conflict in today's world where many different identities are interacting. One aspect of preventing conflict with others is developing a sense of empathy for their position. And Franz De Waal argues that the roots of empathy are evolutionarily deep, and it's something we're increasingly describing outside of the primate lineage. Finally, along these lines, Elizabeth Panisi writes about the prevalence of conciliation and argues that it's present in animal species from primates to birds, so it ought to be present in us.
Great. Well, I can't wait to read it. Thanks for joining me today on the podcast, Sasha.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that concludes the May 18th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sasha Vigneri. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.